A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sen. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 28. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of Time Slip. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon in England.
As we discussed in the previous podcast, Time Slip was a 1970 time travel series that was aimed at children, but it was a complex and involved drama in its own right. Good stuff. And now we're going to look at the third of the four serials, The Year of the Burn-Up. And this time, we go to 1990 again. The previous serial, we went to 1990 in The Year of the Icebox and saw a future with some distasteful scientific research and this very cold Arctic or Antarctic world. And now we're in 1990 again, but it's a different 1990, and maybe that's because it's just a different potential version than we happened to see this one after we saw the other. Or it may be because of the things that Liz and Simon, particularly Liz, decided after seeing the cold, wintry version of 1990 that we already saw.
And they're going to encounter in 1990, again, this sort of prescient nature of Time Slip. They're going to encounter stuff that we're very familiar with now. They're going to encounter climate change and global warming. They're going to, again, be dealing with cloning. There's going to be some discussion of, I don't think they're called stem cells and stem cell research, but clearly that's what they're talking about. And particularly from a British point of view, they're also going to encounter a political master plan, which is led by a politician, a chap known as Controller 2957. And when I was watching it, I couldn't help but think, in political terms, of the New Labour project with the master plan. And, you know, not least because Controller 2957, to a certain extent, looks and sounds like Tony Blair. So I sort of got that echo when I was watching it.
Despite the fact that you were watching a program from many years before those events happened.
From 1970. It was very forward-looking. I mean, a lot of the stuff that they're talking about has actually in some way come to become, you know, quite important.
They did a nice job with that. And they also upped their game yet again when it came to these ideas of the abuse and misuse of science. You had not only global warming, but the idea that humanity was somehow responsible for it, and ideas about things that were being done to combat it, which were very dangerous as well. We also had, yet again, a future version of Liz, so Liz meeting herself in the future. But it's a very different version of Liz in the future. She had one personality and one way of doing things in the other 1990. But in this 1990, she's a very different person doing very different things. That was something that worked quite well in this. We also meet a future version of Simon, and questions about Liz and Simon in the future and Liz and Simon in the present, or the children Liz and Simon traveling into the future, become quite present, and there is something of a romantic relationship developing, but it's one that is slowly developing and one that is a question more than an actual full-out romance.
This is the only time we encounter, I think, a future version of Simon. And as you say, there is the suggestion that there's been some relationship between future Simon and future Liz, which adds an interesting little spin to it as well. The Year of the Burn-Up was the only one of the stories that was extended to 8 episodes. All the rest were 6 episodes, and this one was pushed out to 8 episodes. And I have to say, not necessarily because they had the extra material to run for 8 episodes. This, I think, of the 4 stories does drag a little bit, certainly in the third quarter. And in particular, I think the penultimate episode of this story has a problem, and I suspect it may have been to do with the production difficulties we talked about in the last episode. This is when they had to, possibly when Bruce Stewart was not able to keep up with the writing, or maybe they just had to produce a filler episode. But I think you'll know the one I mean, Brian. There's an episode where they spend a lot of time running across a gravel pit.
That's right.
And they run to one side of this gravel pit, and then they realise that they've left somebody behind, and they run back, and then they run a third time. And there seems to be an awful lot of running around going on with very little actually happening in that episode.
Yes, there did seem to be some padding in this one.
Yeah.
But it was also, if they were going to take any of the four stories out to 8 episodes, I think this one was the best choice. It was probably the most complex of the stories. It was actually pretty involved. There was a lot happening there. So it might have been a little better as 6 episodes, but I think as 8 episodes, it still worked reasonably well.
I think they could have, yes, I think they probably could have squeezed this one down to 6 and got rid of all the running around in the gravel pits. Anyway, it is, I mean, again, as you say, there is some interesting stuff going on in this different future where it's clearly, you know, the earth is heating up and the water is running out. It's all very hot and sweaty and interesting. And the chap who plays Controller 2957, this sort of political figure that we meet, he's played by an actor called David Graham. And a little bit of British Invaders trivia, he was the voice of Parker and Brains in Thunderbirds, apparently. And also, I gather, he was one of the first Dalek voices as well, along with Peter Hawkins.
Now, these are the new conurbations. London, Cardiff, Manchester, Glasgow, Belfast. Eventually, the whole populace will live in these conurbations.
Everybody?
Oh, it makes economic sense. Communications. Now, we've cleared wasteful living space so we can construct fast, efficient throughways like these, you see? Geographical reconstruction. Now, this is carried out in accordance with the overall European plan and allows us to divert rivers, recite lakes, just as we choose. We can even move mountains if we want to. The Atlantic Sea Curtain. Now, this is to hold back water pumped from our latitudes into the Southern Ocean.
Water pumped into the Southern Ocean? Now, why does that have to be done?
Well, ever since the melting of the polar ice caps, we've had something of a flooding problem.
Now, the final story in Time Slip was called Day of the Clone. And this is where the idea of cloning, which gradually becomes more prominent in Time Slip, it was there in Time of the Icebox, it was there in Year of the Burnup more so, and cloning is a big part of this final serial, Day of the Clone. And in this one, there is quite a bit that's involved in the present day, and they also go back in time, but instead of all the way back 30 years in the past, they only go 5 years into the past, to 1965.
And again, in the past, they're going to meet up with Trainer, and they're also going to encounter Devereaux again. And I think really they're going to see the sort of start of Devereaux's plans and his research and the start of human cloning, because they'll come across some weird experiments being carried out on human volunteers. And some of the experiments have quite nasty side effects. So things don't go terribly well for some of the people involved, and we get to see some of the effects. And it's all quite dramatic stuff, which Liz and Simon sort of stumble across, as they usually do once through the time barrier. And once again, there's a little bit of jumping backwards and forwards. They jump back between 1965 and 1970 a couple of times to keep the story moving along.
Yes, there is some interesting stuff going on in this one. They bring things more to a head in figuring out what's actually happening with Trainer and Devereaux, and what are these things that they've been butting up against essentially every time they've traveled in time. So the things that were happening with Devereaux in Time of the Icebox come into play in Day of the Clone. Some of the things from Year of the Burnup come into play with Day of the Clone. And a few of the things even from the first serial, The Wrong End of Time, they come up in here as well. So this is a standalone story, but you do have the threads from all the previous ones being woven in too. And I enjoyed that. I thought that worked pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, quite obviously, we don't want to give too much away, but there are revelations in the fourth story. And as you say, you can look back and see they've actually been building up towards those through the whole 26 episodes. So we do get some answers in the Day of the Clone. I have to say, we also get quite a lot more questions as well. Not everything is going to be wrapped up by the end of the 26 episodes. There will still be things that we don't quite understand.
That's quite true.
So there were some spin-offs from the Time Slip TV show that we've been talking about. In particular, the one I remember was that there was a comic strip version in a magazine called Lookin', which was a children's television-related magazine of the 1970s that was quite popular. And they produced 4 different stories featuring Simon and Liz and their adventures through the time barrier. And I think what they did with those stories was they perhaps turned it into a slightly more straightforward time travel romp, so that they would basically go back into the fire, the Great Fire of London, or back to Egyptian times, or they'd go forward. In a way, I suppose it was slightly more traditional time travel fare, without all this interlinking science stuff and the impact of personal decisions that we've been talking about. But they are actually, they're available online if you want to check them out. If you go to a website that we've mentioned already, the official Timeslip website, which is timeslip.org.uk, you can actually find all four of the comic strips are on the site. They've been put up there thanks to, I think, IPC Media, so you can check those out.
And those were actually the only additional Timeslip stories that we have. You had the four from the TV broadcast, and the only others that were done under license were those look-in comic strips. There was also a Timeslip novel, but it was a novelization of the first two stories, The Wrong End of Time and Time of the Icebox. And that was written by James Boswell, who was involved in the original construction of the story and putting things together at the beginning with his wife, Ruth Boswell, who was basically the creator of it. But he wrote that, and I believe that was one novel that covered both of those stories. And that was released in 1970 as a tie-in with the TV series, which was current at the time, as were the look-in magazines. Both of those were done at the same time as the TV series as tie-ins.
And then Victor Pemberton, the writer who'd written the final story, Day of the Clone, he then bought the rights to Timeslip in the early 1990s. And there was quite a bit of talk that there was either going to be a remake or some form of sequel that he was going to write and produce. But sadly, still, none of those have ever come to pass. There has been no remake, no talk of a remake, and no sequel.
Yes, it's unfortunate. Aside from the original 26-episode series and the novel and the comic books, which added some more stories, but not that much, aside from those things, we have no more Timeslip. There certainly were openings at the end of Timeslip that they could have a continuing series. It was definitely written so it summed things up and ended, but you could have a second series that would be a follow-on with the same characters that would be fairly separate but could continue on from it. And that's something that we didn't see, and perhaps there's still a chance that we may see either a remake or a sequel of some sort, or a remake that continues on further in the story.
And it's a bit of a puzzle in a way why they didn't carry on with it back in 1971 when this series finished. You know, as you say, possibly the black and white strike, which affected overseas sales, meant there could be no more Timeslip at the time. But it seems as if they were looking to find their competitor to Doctor Who, and they found one that seemed to be reasonably successful. I mean, it's very fondly remembered and very popular. You wonder why they didn't carry on with it, really.
I think it was fairly popular at the time and had good figures, but they, for one reason or another, decided not to continue.
Yeah, it's strange.
I think it may have slipped your memory, Dr. Fraser, that I was invited to set up this research centre by the government, not by the police.
Yes, I know, Commander.
R1 is a strictly classified establishment. We are responsible only to the Prime Minister himself. We are under no obligation to reveal either the nature or the extent of our work here. Not to anyone, Doctor. And not even in the public interest.
Now, getting into a little bit of what we thought about Timeslip, what we liked or didn't like, we've done that a little bit already as we've gone, but let's get into it a little bit more. There is an awful lot to say in favor of Timeslip. I enjoy it a lot. The aspect of the science and how it's used particularly is good, because they have a nice, fairly novel take on time travel, which is quite good. And not only do they have that different take on time travel, they're constantly looking at these different forms of science, whether it be the 1940s experimental weapons and things like that, or the futuristic work on intelligent enhancement and longevity enhancement and these sorts of things. It really looked at science and the issues of potential future science, and it did that very well.
And it did it without any form of condescension to its young audience. You know, it took this stuff very seriously, and it expected the audience to take it seriously, and it expected the audience in a way to sort of pay attention as they went along, because there was going to be quite a lot of stuff to work out. And they do have, I mean, they have the advantage, obviously, of having Simon be able to explain stuff to Liz as he's figuring it out, which obviously helps the audience. But it was, you know, it was quite complicated stuff as it went along. And as we've said, there's quite a lot of stuff to keep your eye on working towards the end of the four stories. So that worked well. well.
Yes, it's something that you don't see as much of now in children's television. It was a children's program, but really what made it a children's program was that the main characters were in their teens and their parents were involved. Aside from that, nothing that was in it had to be a children's program. It was all very much suitable as a general, all audiences, you know, for adults kind of series. It was just the few things they put in there in how they did the characters to make it a children's series. And that was something that was really nice because it gave you a good children's series and a good series on its own as well.
Which is one of the reasons why it's so well remembered, I guess, because, you know, as the audience has grown up and they recall the fact that it dealt with this science stuff and, you know, the impact of science on society and also the impact of personal decisions, that's probably one of the reasons why it's such, got such a good reputation, that there was serious issues covered.
It also had some pretty solid acting in it. The two main characters, Liz and Simon, the actors were in their teens, and they played basically all of this pretty well. Very well, I would say. They were both characters that were believable. There are some people who like this show who find Simon annoying or who find Liz annoying, but believable. You know, you can really believe that those characters were like that. And the adults in the stories as well, they were basically all pretty solid in the acting and the portrayal of the characters, and that added to things as well in the way that you had character development over the course of it and just nice convincing portrayals.
Yeah, Simon and Liz were very good, and I mean, as you say, they had to carry a lot because they're in obviously pretty much the whole 26 episodes, pretty much the whole time. And they did very well. And it's actually strange. I mean, the actor who played Simon, Spencer Banks, went on to have a career. But interesting, I don't think Cheryl Burfield did much after this at all, which seems strange. And as you say, they do have some slightly annoying character traits when we first meet them, but they become much more likable, I think, as they grow a bit more used to each other as well and have to help each other out of the various scrapes they get into through the time barrier. Some of the other acting, there is occasionally, I think, there are a few people who turn up and you think, ooh, that doesn't work quite so well. Particularly, I think, in the longer story, in the year of the burn-up, there's one or two performances there that jar slightly compared to the rest of the solid work that's going on.
That's true, but all of these major characters that go from one serial to the next are really quite solid, and that was good.
Yeah, they are. The majors are very good. I mean, as I say, I do have a slight problem with John Barron, only because I can't see him as anybody other than CJ in Reggie Perrin, but that's dependent on if you've seen Reggie Perrin.
Yes, I haven't, and I quite liked his performance in this. There were aspects to him that were wooden, but they were supposed to be wooden. They were quite believable because of that. And Liz and Simon did not annoy me at all because the potentially annoying characteristics were believable ones.
There is also, we've mentioned it already, there's the third quarter problem, which was very common to these serials. I mean, we've seen it in Doctor Who stories, where for some reason the third quarter of a story tends to drag a bit, and that's often where there's a bit of padding and they draw things out just to fill the time before getting back to the final episode where everything gets wrapped up with a bit more speed and verve. Again, you know, particularly in the year of the burn-up where they extended it to 8 episodes.
This third quarter issue, or the penultimate episode issue for serials, has been something that Doctor Who fans have been complaining about for approximately 40 years, I would say. It's definitely something you hear about quite a bit.
It's nothing new.
That's right. And there was some of that in here, especially in that longer story, the Year of the Burn-Up. On the whole, I didn't think that was too bad in here. And even the Year of the Burn-Up, I could see it, but it didn't bother me that much. I still quite enjoyed it. And I find with some of these types of serials, as with most serials from this era, if you watch the episodes one at a time or two at a time, rather than watching all of them in a row, the pacing seems much better. It's when you put them all together that the whole feel of the pacing sort of becomes a little wonky. It doesn't work quite as well when you're trying to go all the way through. But when you look at each one individually, it stands alone much better. Where I found that to be the most the case, I think, was with Sapphire and Steel, where I thought it was much better watching separate episodes than trying to watch a whole serial together. Less so in this, but in this I felt that as well.
The writing on the whole is pretty good. I mean, I don't think there's any particular problems, you know, throughout. There's perhaps, I think, just that one episode I keep mentioning,
yes,
the running episode, where I suspect they actually didn't have a writer for,
right,
that episode, and that was part of the problem.
The writing is very good. There are a few minor issues that come up with the writing where there'll be something that isn't quite as believable as I'd like it to be, where Simon, who is always portrayed as being very smart, will not catch on to something immediately or something like that. There are some of these things that are in there, but they're very minor, and it's only because the overall quality is so good that I'm even picking those out at all. It's really a very well-written and well-acted show, and it's one that I'm hesitant to point out too many of the flaws, because on the whole, the flaws are really very minor, and it's really a very strong series.
So, availability. There is Region 2 box set, which is 4 discs, reasonably cheap on Amazon for about £17 at the moment, and that covers the entire 26 episodes. But you might want to look at a Region 1 DVD, Brian.
Yes, the Region 1 DVD is also available for a similar price on Amazon. It's also on 4 discs. It's a similar type of setup. You have all of the episodes in black and white, except for that one episode that still remains in color. But you also have Beyond the Barrier, a short documentary about Time Slip, which is not on the Region 2 box set. I think Beyond the Barrier was filmed a few years before the DVDs came out, but they may not have had the rights cleared for it when the Region 2 set came out, because it was a little bit later that the Region 1 set came out, and it included this extra documentary.
Right. And currently, I mean, if you're in the UK, if you've got a multi-region DVD player, then currently in the UK, Region 1 set is actually cheaper. So it's slightly cheaper and it has the extra documentary on it. So it's perhaps worth looking out for that.
Yes, the extra documentary is not spectacular. It's good. It's fairly short. I think it was maybe 15 or 20 minutes. About 20 minutes, probably.
I haven't had a chance to see it because I have the Region 2 set.
Yes, it did have some nice things in it. Particularly, it was interesting to see Spencer Banks and Cheryl Burfield, these two teenagers, 30-odd years later in their early 50s.
So our recommendations about Time Slip, this series from 1970. I'm going to go first, and I'm going to say that it's a pretty positive review from me. I mean, there's an awful lot to enjoy in Time Slip, and the science issues discussed, as we've mentioned, are very intriguing. I do think it's a slight law of diminishing returns, in that the stories, I think, start extremely strongly and then perhaps get slightly weaker for each one. So I prefer the first story, The Wrong End of Time, which is very good, and despite the complicated plot that we described, is actually a fantastic watch and a very good self-contained story. And then on with The Time of the Icebox, that's very good as well. But then perhaps I was less keen on The Year of the Burn-Up and Day of the Clone, which didn't quite hold my attention as well. So it's a sort of a mixed recommendation from myself.
I actually liked all 4 of these serials. I see some of the issues in the later ones, but despite them, I quite enjoyed them as well, particularly the 4th one, Day of the Clone. I thought it was very good. I thought it was well done. It was a well-written and acted series. I thought it was really well put together. I think it's well worth checking out. It's worth it as a kid's series if you want something that is a little different from the current things that are out there now and has some good meat to it in the story and the acting to show your kids, then I think it's a great choice for that. It's also a good story for anyone. It's good stuff to watch. And it is in black and white, which gives it a nice, moody, atmospheric quality. If you don't usually watch things in black and white, you should try it. There are definitely some positives to watching things in black and white. And although this was originally in color, it works well in black and white. So it's a good thing to try out for that, too. So definitely a strong recommendation for me on this one.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, as you say, I think it is one of those ones that does actually look better in black and white. It does help it.
So, in summary, Time Slip was a 1970 time travel series that was a series for children that was complex enough that it was a good series for adults as well as for children. It involved two teenagers, Liz and Simon, traveling through time or into echoes of the past and potential versions of the future and learning things about the present from the past and from the future and learning about the consequences of things. And there were ideas about science and the misuse of science and the abuse of science and all kinds of interesting things like this happening in it. So our next discussion, next time on British Invaders, we will be talking about The Nightmare Man, which was a 1981 BBC adaptation of Child of Vaudenoy, a novel by David Wilshire. So that should be an interesting one to talk about as well.
There's lots of spooky goodness in that one.
Certainly. That wraps us up for this one. So this is Brian from Canada signing off.
And this is an echo of Eamon in the past saying goodbye until the future.